Lecture 9, Mobility, Media, and Contemporary English.
The channels of human communication have changed profoundly over the 20th and into the 21st century, as we all know well. The 20th century saw the increasing use of the telephone and radio, the birth of television, and of course, the dawn of the personal computer and the inauguration of the internet age. Today, social networking, texting, tweeting, multitasking, multi-communicating, really, have become a way of life, for better or worse. So, language has been flowing through different channels, and so have people. Historically, there were three major patterns of population movement that shaped American English, from east to west, from south to north, and from rural areas to America's cities. The 20th and early 21st centuries have seen changes in two of these. African Americans reversed their earlier mass migration out of the South into more northerly areas, and many Americans, mostly white, moved from city centers into more suburban areas. But now, people are going back to the city once again, with the rise of gentrification. How have these changing channels of communication impacted American English? Let's think first about population movements. In 1910, about 90% of African Americans lived in the South. 75% of these lived in small communities of less than 2,500. Just 60 years later, in 1970, nearly half of all African Americans lived outside the South, 77% of them in cities. So, a radical movement from South to North and from rural to urban. When sociolinguists first started studying African American vernacular English in the 1960s, they studied it in the context of northern cities. They concluded that AAVE and white vernacular varieties of American English were very different. Only later would they come to realize that AAVE actually has a good bit in common with southern white dialects. For example, pronunciations like tam for time, and grammatical features like absence of be in sentences like they nice. Lately, African Americans have been moving from the north back to the south, to southern cities like Atlanta, Houston, and Memphis. And even when they don't relocate, they tend to be more mobile. There's more travel from the north to the south for events like family reunions and church homecomings. And there's travel from southern rural areas to cities for cultural events and family visits. Now, when people from different regions intermingle, the result is dialect mixing and often the leveling out of regional differences into a more widespread uniform language variety. And so, the 20th century saw the rise of a pan-regional vernacular norm for African-American English, especially in terms of grammar. Some of the widely used grammatical features of AAVE are long-standing forms retained across the centuries. These include constructions like they friendly and she drive. Others are newer. The use of be to show habitual aspect in sentences like he be working all the time increased dramatically during the course of the 20th century. And more recent forms arose too. For example, yesterday he had called me to indicate past tense, not past perfect. This doesn't mean there's no regional variation left in AAVE. There are still differences between northern and southern varieties and across different northern cities. African Americans who migrated to East Coast cities following the Civil War and the two World Wars came mostly from the coastal South, North and South Carolina. Those who moved into Midwestern cities like St. Louis, Chicago, and Detroit came mostly from the Deep South. And along with these different streams of migration came different dialect features. One example is the use of V for TH sounds like th or the, as in something like brother for brother and smooth for smooth. This is often listed as a feature of AAVE in general, but it's actually more common in Midwestern urban varieties than in coastal cities like Washington, Philadelphia, and New York. Interestingly, it's also a feature of Cockney English in London. This shows us yet again that dialects that are vastly different from one another can still share features, and that linguistic usages have virtually nothing to do with biological race. White Americans have also been moving from north to south in recent decades. Businesses are moving southward to favorable economic climes, and individuals follow for jobs and for warmer weather. Sometimes the linguistic effect of this new pattern of southward movement is dialect leveling, but sometimes it's just the opposite. Sociolinguist Guy Bailey and his colleagues have traced the spread of several dialect features across the southwestern state of Oklahoma. One of these is the merger of the vowels in word pairs like caught and caught into a single vowel, caught. The merger came in with northern transplants, and its effect was the leveling out of a long-standing pronunciation distinction. The new feature diffused throughout the state in a so-called hierarchical pattern, first from city to city, then into less densely populated areas. But this doesn't mean that Oklahoma is completely succumbing to the speechways of northern newcomers. Some southern features are holding their own, and some are even spreading. One example is the phrase fixin' to, as in, I'm fixin' to go to the store. This means I'm just about ready to go. And interestingly, fixin' to is spreading the exact opposite way as the spread of the non-southern caught-caught merger. It's diffusing from rural areas into bigger cities in a pattern called contra-hierarchical diffusion. So, both whites and blacks have been moving from north to south, and African Americans have been migrating from rural to urban areas. European Americans initially moved in the same direction, from the rural U.S. into urban centers, or straight from Europe into large American cities. As people from different backgrounds came together to share geographic space, their languages and their dialects gradually lost their geographic associations and took on connotations of ethnic group membership rather than national origin, per se. For example, Jewish people from a wide variety of national backgrounds developed a highly distinctive English dialect with general associations of Jewish ethnicity, Jewish American English. And dialect features originally associated with rural locations began to connote rural values, hardworkingness, simplicity, and conservatism, as opposed to fast-paced and flashy big city ways. But the parallel movement patterns began to diverge after World War II. European Americans stopped moving into cities and began moving out, into suburbs. They were lured by cheaper housing and bigger properties. And let's be honest, they were moving away from African Americans, fueled by racial prejudices that have persisted since the first slaves were brought to America from West Africa. This white flight from cities to suburbs led to population segregation and to the increasing linguistic differentiation of African American English from white dialects. Since the latter years of the 20th century, upper and middle class people, usually white, have been returning to the cities from which they once fled. They're transforming lower-income urban areas into posh neighborhoods. They're gentrifying. One of the most studied and most extreme cases of gentrification in the U.S. is where I live and work, in Washington, D.C. My colleagues, students, and I have been studying the linguistic effects of gentrification on both longtime urban residents, usually African American, and on recent transplants from the suburbs. In D.C., gentrifiers include both whites and African Americans. Many affluent African Americans who were raised in the D.C. suburbs are moving into lower-income urban neighborhoods, often the very same ones their parents or grandparents moved out of. Now, the revitalization of lower-income neighborhoods can be a good thing. It brings diverse people together and brings in new businesses and services. But it also brings rising property values, and longtime residents can be displaced, or at least marginalized. And so gentrification can stir up lots of social and economic tensions, and it can bring resistance. And sometimes when people don't have the economic resources or population numbers to fight back against encroaching forces, they muster linguistic defenses. Our studies of gentrifying neighborhoods in D.C. show that people do show linguistic resistance. This can be fairly overt. For example, long-term residents and gentrifiers might refer to one another as those people rather than our neighbors. But linguistic resistance can also be subtle. My colleague Rob Podesva found that working-class African Americans in one gentrifying D.C. neighborhood used higher rates for one particular feature of African American English when talking about white people who were moving in than when talking about other topics. This feature involves the pronunciation of words like west and end as wes and n. It's called consonant cluster reduction because it involves reducing a word final cluster of two consonants down to just one. So the st at the end of west becomes s, and the nd in end becomes n. All English speakers use this feature to an extent, even in formal conversation. We all typically say west side, not west side. We reduce consonant clusters that come before word initial consonants. In African American vernacular English, the pattern's extended. There's reduction before consonants, so west side, but also before vowels, west end, and at the ends of phrases, as in, this is the end. So consonant cluster reduction, AAVE, demonstrates yet again that this language variety is in some ways actually more regularly patterned than so-called standard English. The pattern doesn't just hold in some cases, it extends across the board. Now, it's a subtle pattern, but again, it's part of a strategy for showing linguistic resistance to gentrifiers who use different dialect patterns. When the gentrifiers are African Americans rather than whites, even more nuanced linguistic negotiations are needed. My colleague Jesse Greaser studied how D.C. African Americans in a neighborhood being gentrified by both whites and blacks used a variety of features of African American English. These included features of African American vernacular English and a feature associated with the speech of middle-class African Americans, the pronunciation of words like cab and bed as more like cap and bet. In this study, people used more of the bet for bed pronunciation, the middle-class feature, when talking about topics like work and higher education, the professional arena. But when they started talking about the neighborhood and the changes currently affecting it, they used more features of vernacular African American English. For example, sentence structures like he nice and she walk. And this included not only the working class residents, but also, in fact, especially the gentrifiers, African American professionals who had moved back into the home neighborhood. In other words, African American gentrifiers use subtle patterns of linguistic variation, mixing and matching features of middle-class and working-class African-American English to indicate that they are at once oriented toward their professional identities and toward their neighborhoods and toward African-American ethnicity. So, the movement of populations from suburbia back to the city has its linguistic effects, just like movements from south to the north and back again, and from the country to the city. All of these movements have impacted the English varieties of Americans in the nation's capital and American dialects across the country. Now, what about changes in the movement and spread of information? How does that affect American English? People often presume that the media are a powerful force in language change. They also tend to believe that the continued proliferation and diversification of mediated communication will inevitably flatten out dialect differences, and maybe even language differences. After all, English is the chief language of the internet, so isn't English bound to eventually supplant the other languages of the world, or at least many of them? Let's tackle the first issue first. What's the role of the media in the spread of linguistic innovations? If I hear new words and phrases on TV, and I like them, isn't it likely that I'll start using them myself, as will others who like the new usages too? The media should be a driving force in language change, right? Interestingly, sociolinguists have long maintained the exact opposite. They've held that the media actually don't have much of an impact on language change. Sure, we may pick up a few scattered words or phrases from TV and social network sites. You probably still remember some old advertising lines from years ago. Got milk? Or where's the beef? But when it comes to deeper changes, alterations in phonological or grammatical systems, sociolinguists have maintained that we need face-to-face interaction. Superficial, passive exposure to news anchors, movie stars, and participants in the latest reality show just isn't enough. In recent years, sociolinguists have begun calling their received wisdom into question. They've begun testing their claim about the non-influence of media on language. After all, there are a lot more media outlets than there used to be, and a lot of them are pretty interactive. Now, there are a couple of ways we can go about studying media effects on the spread of language change. Some researchers have investigated the dissemination of linguistic innovations with a wide, even global reach. These are likely candidates for the possible spread via media. How else could a new language feature leap from the U.S. all the way to Australia and New Zealand in a relatively short amount of time? One of the most studied global innovations in English is the use of the verb to be with like to introduce quotes in a sentence like, I was like, I never realized there was so much to learn about dialects. This feature is called quotative be like. It can be used for real quotes and also for possible or imagined quotes. Maybe something I was thinking but didn't actually say. So, for example, I was like, I don't believe he just said that to me. You're probably familiar with it. It's ubiquitous these days in the US, Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and beyond. And like many newer changes, people talk about it a lot, often pretty negatively. Sociolinguists all over the world have traced the origin and spread of quotative be like and have come up with some facts that seem to point to media diffusion. There's agreement that the feature has a short history, that it accelerated extremely rapidly, and that it now has a global reach, especially among younger people. Sociolinguist Sally Tagliamonti maintains that it has its geographic origins in California. And she also pinpoints its precise generational origins. She says, quote, regardless of locality, individuals born in the 1970s started using be-like, end quote, regardless of locality. Now that's intriguing, isn't it? This seems to be a clear-cut case of the diffusion of a linguistic innovation through media influence. Essentially, a soundstage in Hollywood could have launched be-like around the world. Or could it? To be certain, we'd have to look beyond how the feature has spread or sprung up in various population groups. We'd also have to look for it in the media of the time. Tagliamonti investigated this, and she found that be-like actually wasn't very prevalent in TV and movies in the 1970s. So either we need to do a more thorough search of 1970s media, or we need to consider whether language changes can spread that far, that fast, without the benefit of broadcast media. It's possible. All languages and dialects are constantly changing, and some changes are so natural that they really can spring up independently in locations far removed from one another. We've seen it before in the history of English. The regularization of irregular verbs is a natural change that has affected English all over the world, regardless of the extent of interaction across population groups. It just makes sense to iron out difficulties like work rot, help hope, in favor of regular patterns we don't have to memorize. Work worked, help helped. English speakers the world over have also leveled out most verb endings having to do with subject-verb agreement, and they continue to flatten them out. For example, the leveling of past tense be is so commonplace that sociolinguists have referred to it as a so-called vernacular universal. So, I was, you was, he was, we was, they was. And so is the use of ain't, despite English teachers' persistent efforts to stamp it out. So, maybe the spread of like into quotative uses is a natural change, too. Like is a versatile word. It's long been a verb, as in I like ice cream, and a comparator, in this tastes like ice cream. And we've all heard it as an interjection or intensifier in sentences such as, this ice cream is like so good. I know, you probably hate that usage. But believe it or not, even this feature has rules. You can't just throw in likes anywhere you want. It has to go either at the beginning of the sentence, like, this ice cream is so good, or it has to go between the is and the adjective phrase. This ice cream is like so good. Like cannot come between the subject and the verb. This ice cream like is so good. That's actually ungrammatical in youth speak. It's not a big leap from like as verb, comparator, and intensifier to like as quotative, especially for imagined quotes. So if I say, I was like, I don't believe it, I'm sort of saying it was as if I just said it. So be like is not unnatural anyway, and it's possible it sprung up spontaneously in different world Englishes without media influence. It's also possible that the change was poised and ready to happen, and then it was helped along by media influence, maybe through TV shows from the 1980s. Sociolinguist Peter Trudgill has always been skeptical of media influence on language change, but he does maintain that the media can have what he calls a softening up effect. Media can help accelerate the pace of changes that are already incipient. So, in order to really get at the possible effects of media influence on the spread of a particular language change, we need to study how people use the feature in everyday life and how the feature is used in the media. We also need to consider other possible channels of influence and reasons for change. And there's another factor. Ideally, we also need to study whether and to what extent people actually interact with various media sources. Sociolinguists are only now beginning to undertake such comprehensive studies, but their findings so far are fascinating. The leading researcher in this regard is Jane Stuart Smith. She and her research team have found that, believe it or not, people's exposure to linguistic features in TV shows does not seem to correlate with their use of the features in everyday life. Instead, what really matters is whether or not people engage with the TV shows. Do they like them? Do they care what happens to the characters? Do they become emotionally involved? And beyond this, it also matters how much engagement people have with the social groups and social practices in their immediate surroundings. When people adopt language features, they adapt them. They use them to suit their local social purposes. We don't pick up TV usages because we want to sound like people on TV. We adopt them because the features have become meaningful for us, personally, and for our friends, in day-to-day, face-to-face interaction. So in the long run, the enduring sociolinguistic premise that the media really don't have much effect on language change is actually right in a way. The media do have an impact, but only when we let them. We're not just passive recipients. We decide what media we'll consume, to an extent anyway, and we decide what impacts they'll have on us, linguistic and otherwise. Communications researchers agree. Non-experts tend to assume that we take in and repeat the behaviors we see, hear, and read about in the media that surround us. For example, violent movies lead to violent behavior and so on. But this is actually not true. We have a lot more say than we give ourselves credit for, and our local sociocultural surroundings are still our most important influence, even in this age of increasing globalization. In some ways, the diffusion of language features is like the spread of a fast food chain. McDonald's is spread all over the world, but the menu items are different in different countries, and even different regions of the U.S. You can sometimes get crab cakes at McDonald's in Maryland, but you're never going to see them in California, or even in the neighboring states of Pennsylvania or Virginia. And you're certainly not going to be able to order a McDonald's crab cake in Germany, even though you could order a beer. So, the media have some impact on the spread of language change, but probably not nearly as much as we may think. But what about the role of the media in the spread of linguistic norms, in the leveling out of dialect differences, and even language differences? Especially social media, since it's so much more interactive than traditional broadcast media. Well, there are some surprising answers to this question, too. Computational linguist Jacob Eisenstein has conducted some very interesting research on social media and dialect variation. He studied the tweets, the Twitter messages, of 2.77 million users across the U.S., 114 million messages, to see whether there's any regional variation or if it's all just one big internet dialect. And his findings? People actually do use regional dialect words in social media. They also use regional grammatical structures and spellings that reflect dialect pronunciations. Some of these show the same regional distribution as in speech. For example, yins for plural you is closely confined to the Pittsburgh area. There's also another dialect word, John. It originated in speech in the Philadelphia area, and it has a wide range of context-dependent meanings. Most generally, it means something that's, well, a thing. So something like, I was at Bill's John last night, to mean I was at Bill's party, Bill's thing, or look at that car, that John is hot, to mean that thing is really nice. At any rate, Eisenstein's study shows that even in cyberspace, John is confined mostly to the Philadelphia area. So it may be even more regionally restricted in social media than in the world of in-person interaction. I know for a fact that John, or its variant Jont, is used in Washington, D.C. My research team has documented it. But it doesn't seem to be used in D.C. area tweets. Not yet, anyway. Other features associated with regional English dialects have spread beyond their origins in the Twitter sphere. Southern y'all is tweeted from all over the country, and the intensifier word hella, which means something like very, very, originated in Northern California, but is also used in tweets across the U.S. So someone from Philadelphia might tweet, "This cheesesteak is hella great." Or, with a bit of mixing and matching, "This John is hella great," whatever John refers to. So regional variation can persist in cyberspace, and features originating in regional spoken varieties can be incorporated into the language of the internet. It's not all standard English, not all general American, but it is English. And there's no doubt that the prevalence of English on the internet has impacted countries far beyond the U.S., including countries whose primary native language is something other than English. And even when they aren't responsible for the spread of particular linguistic usages, the internet and other media can spread language attitudes, values, and styles. According to sociolinguist Tore Christensen, the media spread the idea, often subconsciously, that modern linguistic forms are better than conservative ones, and that informal language is better than formal. Christensen also maintains that the media promote language styles that connote self-assurance and excitement, often over and above values like intelligence and trustworthiness, attributes we associate with conventional, standard, or formal language. So if media influence on language styles persists, maybe soon we'll all be talking in sound bites, if we aren't already. One very prominent sociolinguist, Nicholas Coupland, points out that when it comes to media and language, probably the biggest influence of all is that our communication has simply become much more mediated, much more reliant on an array of technologies and practices that were simply unimaginable in 1607 Jamestown or even 1970s New York City. So, computers, mobile phones, smartwatches, texting, tweeting, and multitasking. And what about how mixed up everything is getting? I can dictate a text. Why would I do that instead of making a phone call? And I can email you the link to a website when I'm sitting right next to you in the same office. Why don't I just talk to you? It's not so much that the media have a big impact on linguistic systems or structures. They have a slight impact on lexical items, not much at all on grammar or pronunciation. They might help accelerate the spread of big global languages like English, but there are undoubtedly many other forces at work too, economic, cultural, political, and so on. I like how Sally Tagliamonti puts it. She says, "Apparently social media do not replace the networks that exist in the real world. Instead, they reinforce them and make them stronger." Where the media really affect language is in their profound impact on communication practices. The media really are indelibly shaping American language and behaviors and language attitudes, even though American English and American regional and social dialects aren't going anywhere anytime soon.